From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. I just returned from Charlotte, North Carolina. I was at an event called The Seminar. It's an annual event where the nation's leading public affairs officers from major companies all meet to learn, talk about issues, and they wanted me there to talk about you. They want to get a better understanding of what the late night listener is all about, what you're looking for, what you like, what you don't like. It's a pretty fascinating meeting. And I had a chance to meet Barry from Rock Hill. That's right. Barry checks in with us every once in a while, avid Coast to Coast listener. He came by just to say hi. Later tonight, channeling George Harrison. Get ready for that, but here's what's happening. A U.S.-led international operation disrupted a crime ring that infected hundreds of thousands of PCs around the globe with malicious software used for stealing banking credentials and extorting computer owners. Authorities in nearly a dozen countries worked with private security companies to wrest control of the network of infected machines, known by the name of its master software, Game Over Zeus. Court documents said that between 500,000 and 1 million machines worldwide were infected with this malicious software, which was derived from the original Zeus Trojan for stealing financial passwords that emerged back in 2006. What an amazing story. And Apple, well, they took the wraps off their mobile applications that pool and analyze health and home data, kicking off its annual developers conference, but they lacked big surprises despite hopes that the iPhone maker would offer a glimpse into its secretive pipeline of products. Nothing really there. Let's check in with the expert, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, this was a little disappointing, I'm told.
Yeah, you know, I have to admit, since Steve died, it's harder to find the real blockbusters. That isn't to say there wasn't, you know, there weren't important announcements today. This was the official launch of iOS 8, and so that of course is the system that's used by the iPhones and iPads and such. And there were, you know, there was a lot of technical announcements, new application programming interfaces, and improvements in messaging and notifications and all sorts of things like that. They announced their health kit, which is to aggregate health-related data, like from wearables and things like that, and the home kit, which is to it's like a typical kind of smart home application where you have access to your cameras and you can turn your heat on from remotely and things like that. These are all, you know, useful things, but they're really doesn't seem to be a lot of excitement for consumers. Now, for developers, there was more because they did announce a new programming language. It seems like, you know, there's a lot of new programming languages coming out the pipe these days. It's always interesting to see which ones will get traction. This one is called Swift, and it's oriented toward developers. It's not really oriented toward you know, consumers, obviously. So that may turn out to be the most important thing that they announced. We don't know yet.
But no pizzazz this time.
Yeah, not really. No new hardware to speak of. You know, there are rumors that there are things, you know, things coming, of course, to television oriented and things like that. But this really turned out to be more of a technical, technical set of announcements and sort of cleanups a lot of these things like messaging and notifications and things, they'd kind of been lagging compared with some other systems, and it's probably about time that these were brought up to speed.
Lauren, what did you think of this hacking story where the U.S. cracked down on a number of hackers?
Yeah, the botnets are everywhere, aren't they? Yeah, these stories all sort of sound the same after a while because we're basically playing whack-a-mole in a lot of ways here. And the reason that these bot networks are so pervasive is because the operating systems that we run, primarily Windows, are so insecure it's easy, you know, relatively for these kinds of malicious malware systems to get embedded, and once they're there, they spread like a biological virus. So, good work. Good work was done to knock this one down. But of course, this was just probably a drop in the bucket compared with the overall number of these things running out there. And that's just the world we're living in right now.
It sure is, Lauren. Thanks so much. If you send a text message in the dark, be careful. Listen to this story. A 26-year-old man from China has suffered a detached retina after hours of sending text messages to his girlfriend in the dark. Using his cell phone messaging app, he was using WeChat. He was required to undergo emergency surgery after his eyesight became plagued with sudden flashes, and he discovered that his left eye's retina had simply become detached. Wow. Increasing numbers of young Americans are heading to college where they're racking up debt to pay for rapidly increasing tuition costs. Those graduating are being confronted by a challenging job market, which eventually leads many to just drop out of the labor force altogether. And this in turn has led to an increase of delinquency rate for student loan borrowers as well. So it's no surprise that young people are increasingly opting, perhaps out of necessity, to live at home with their parents. In the latest monthly chart book, Deutsche Bank tracks the rise of 18 to 34-year-olds currently in this position, and they say there are a lot that are going home to live with their parents. Trends expert Gerald Salenti with us. And Gerald, when I was at the seminar today in Charlotte, North Carolina, I talked about you a lot. I bet your nose was itchy, huh?
Thank you.
So these kids, 18 to 34-year-olds, they're going back home.
Well, you look at the numbers, George. You know, we call this the re-extended family back in Trends 2000. We saw it coming. First of all, college debt is more than higher than credit card debt. Half the kids that get jobs, half the college grads, rather, that are either unemployed or underemployed. And then you have all of the people that didn't go to college that can't find good jobs because the manufacturing jobs have left. And then you look at the people that are getting married. That's down over 6% since the Great Recession began. And there's another one in this. The parents are asking the kids to come back home or not leave home because they can't afford to pay the taxes, the school taxes, property taxes, and they've lost their jobs. So this is a trend that we're just seeing the beginning of over here.
Well, you know, when you were with us talking about the 2008 bubble before the bubble hit, you've been talking about, another crisis just ahead. Are you still feeling that, Gerald?
Well, let's talk about exactly this. You're seeing young people can't buy homes. And interest rates are at record lows.
Yes.
This is unprecedented in world history. Not only in the U.S., now they're talking about this week in the European Central Bank, they're going to have negative interest rates. So, George, when these interest rates go up, bam, the economy goes down.
Oh, and it can't stay this low. You're right, Gerald. Eventually it's going to go up. The Fed itself can't keep these rates at this point. I think they're getting antsy, aren't they?
Yes, and then when you go back again to this critical issue here with tapering, and what are they going to do? They're going to keep cutting back on the bond buying, and then you're going to start seeing more panic in those so-called emerging markets that were making all this dough because of the quantitative easing and the cheap money flowing into these countries. Another important thing, George, on the people moving back home, look at where most of the new construction's going. Multi-family dwelling, apartments.
Right.
Kids can't afford to buy homes.
TrendsResearch.com, track Gerald Salenti and his work. Thanks, Gerald. Well, there's a new class of planet out there that astronomers are calling the Mega Earth. It's an object with a hard surface like our own world, but much, much bigger. The necessity for the new designation follows the discovery of a planet which has a mass some 17 times that of good old planet Earth. In Union, Missouri, aldermen there have voted against putting fluoride in the drinking water system. Now, an area dentist there testified, hey, it's got benefits. But they said, nope, we want it out. They were talking about repairing the fluoridation machines, and they decided, nah, we're not even going to do that. I wonder if this is going to happen around the country. Some drought-stricken rivers and streams in Northern California's coastal forests are being polluted and sucked dry by water-guzzling medical marijuana farms. According to wildlife officials, they say it's an issue that has spurred at least one county to try to outlaw personal growth. We'll see. And the most recent farm bill is allowing a handful of farmers across the country to put hemp, the non-psychoactive cousin of marijuana, back in the ground. And what does that all mean? In a moment, we check in with Doug Fine. His book, Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Doug Fine, our guest for the next couple hours. Split show for you tonight. He is a comedic investigative journalist, best-selling author, solar-powered goat herder. He has reported from five continents for the Washington Post, Wired, Salon, the New York Times, Outside, National Public Radio, the U.S. News and World Report. His work from Burma was read into the congressional record by none other than pro-hemp Senator Mitch McConnell, and he won more than a dozen Alaska Press Club awards for his radio reporting from the last frontier. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Doug Fine, with his latest work, Hemp Bound. Hey, Doug, welcome.
Oh, my gosh, it's so great to be back on Coast to Coast.
Hey, my friend, great job with hemp. And I want to go back a little bit in terms of the days of Hearst. And when hemp was literally legal and they were using it everywhere, I was told that he used to own all these forests of trees, and he wanted to do away with hemp because it was being used for paper and everything else. Is that true?
The answer is it's almost certainly true. If I could get access to a time machine, what I would want to do is go to the wood-paneled club with the brandies and the cigars where Hearst and DuPont and all the people that stood to benefit from hemp becoming illegal had their meetings. We don't have the smoking gun. All we know is Hearst villainized cannabis in his newspapers, and it certainly benefited him and his cronies, and we paid for it for 77 years. But the good news is hemp is back.
It is coming back. It's coming back in a big way. This farm bill, is that going to open up the doors for farmers to really start growing hemp?
Yes. It's a first step in that it only allows research connected with universities in states that have hemp laws to start getting to redeveloping our cultivars. It's kind of a sad story. We had the hemp seed that was the envy of the world. Everybody wanted Kentucky hemp seed. And at the beginning of my research, I talked to a researcher who went to the National Seed Repository in Virginia to look and see if the genetics were still there. And all there were two open bags with rotted seed in them. So we have to start from scratch and rebuild.
Now, hemp, of course, the same species as marijuana, different variety. It lacks THC, which, of course, gives users a high when they smoke it or ingest it. Is that true?
Right. The world over, and every place in the world, cultivates hemp. And I should say Canada's industry has had exactly zero cases of confusion between hemp and psychoactive cannabis in their industry, which, by the way, is going to be worth $1 billion this year. So we've got $1 billion worth of catch-up to do. There's no way to confuse those two kinds of plants. You're absolutely right. Hemp is defined as 0.3% of THC or less. And the reason there's no way to confuse the two is that the pollen from hemp would immediately ruin the very valuable psychoactive cannabis flowers that have no seeds in them, no males at all. The only thing that people buy and smoke are the female flowers. So you can't even grow the two varieties in the same place.
Now, this push for hemp now that's starting to grow, tell me the benefits of this. Why do they want hemp out there on the marketplace?
The first and foremost reason is economic. The Canadian farmers today are making $300 profit per acre on hemp, which is up to 10 times more than what they're making on corn and wheat and soy. So all the other sort of earth-saving and beneficial qualities of hemp that we can talk about all stem from the fact that farmers are businessmen and businesswomen, and they are going to be making money. And that's from the hemp seed oil, which is a nutritive superfood. It's very high in omega fatty acids, minerals, and protein. From there, though, the fiber. Today, even, there's hemp fiber in Mercedes door panels because it's stronger than steel. This is not some sort of hippie issue. And the third really big application that I think is going to be huge for America
is energy. Hemp produces so much biomass per acre that we can use it as biomass combustion in our power plants to help us get off coal and dependence on foreign fuels.
I remember back in 1998 in St. Louis, a guy called me up when I was doing my local show, Doug, and he said, I have a hemp mobile. And I went, a what? And he says, yeah, I want to drive it over, and we'll have your producer get in it and drive around with me, and then you can interview me. And I said, what's a hemp mobile? He had to tell me again. And he said, it runs on hemp fuel, hemp oil. And he came by, and sure enough, that's what it did. It was an amazing device. I guess he's still out there somewhere.
Yes, I got to take a hemp-powered limo ride while I was doing my hemp research. It works as biodiesel, and we may see that in the future. I just think that we're going to see it first in the power plant and second at the fuel pump.
Would you use it in place of ethanol?
You could. The issue with ethanol, and this is true of corn ethanol today, that it takes more energy in than it gives out. We really aren't ready for prime time on ethanol. And that was the very first question I asked when I started researching hemp. You can do it, but ethanol as a science overall really isn't quite ready for prime time yet. But on this biomass combustion thing, the Europeans are doing it. There's a town called Feldheim, Germany, that became completely energy independent by taking its farm waste, putting it in these, they call them gasification units. They're not very expensive. The U.S. Army's buying them up. They're only the size of a big outhouse. And what they do is they're super high heat anaerobic combustion that's very carbon-friendly energy that produces steam and can power your power plants without any of the dependence on foreign oil or on the coal, which isn't so great for the atmosphere.
Doug, the DEA, I don't think, is too thrilled with the possibility of hemp being grown all over the country. How come?
I have to look at it as bureaucratic turf protection. I guess if I were in charge of an agency whose employees' livelihoods were threatened by a major, major change in policy, I guess I would try to protect those jobs as well, but it's too important for America that we get this plant back in the ground. We're down to 1% of Americans farming today, for one thing, and 30% of Americans were farming when hemp prohibition started in 1937, that's 77 years ago. It's simply too important to allow the silly untruths to be said about this plant when it's just so good for the country on so many levels. Last year, a farmer named Ryan Laughlin in Colorado, even before the Farm Bill reauthorized hemp, he planted 60 acres on a federally subsidized family farm in Colorado, a very conservative part of eastern Colorado, and he put that farm at risk. They could have been raided at any time. Thank God they weren't. But one of the things he showed was that hemp uses half the water that the wheat crop he had planted the previous year uses. That's big news for farmers the world over. Half the water of wheat.
Now, hemp is, I guess if it doesn't have the THC, can you call it a drug?
Absolutely not, and that's one of the things that's happening now. You asked, is it really back as a result of this farm bill? It's back for research, but there is another bill going through Congress this year that I very much hope will pass. It's S-359, and it will do just what we're talking about. It will say, you know what, this is not, shouldn't be under the Controlled Substances Act and the Justice Department and the DEA at all. It should be under the USDA, like tomatoes and broccoli, and hopefully that will pass.
So here's a substance, hemp, that is not a drug, doesn't have THC in it, and it is illegal to grow right now?
It's illegal to grow for commercial purposes, except in Colorado. Colorado has decided to go further than federal law, and they issued commercial cultivation permits to their farmers this year. There's 1,600 acres. That's nothing compared to what we're going to start seeing when the federal law allows commercial cultivation. But the only thing that's legal federally now is university-associated research plots, and that's what Kentucky's doing in 15 other states.
And it's a pretty hardy plant, I take it.
So hardy that the harvesters and combines have to be adjusted for how strong the fiber is and how dense the biomass is, that, you know, just grows so intensely per acre that it can catch your combine on fire if you don't know how to harvest it correctly.
Doug, stay with us. We're going to come back and talk more with you about this. Hempbound on Coast to Coast Day. Welcome back to Coast, Doug Fine with us, his book, Hemp Bound. Here's some hemp trivia for you. Did you know that Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote his Declaration of Independence, that the draft was on hemp paper, and that Betsy Ross, when she made her first flag, it was made from the hemp plant as well? That's kind of cool, Doug.
It is cool, and you expressed it exactly right, George. A lot of people say that the Declaration of Independence, that the final draft was written on it, but actually in those days they would write the final draft on parchment and seal it up and, you know, put the wax stamp on it and deliver it to the king in a hear ye kind of way. But you're right, it was the go-to paper. You could pay your taxes in colonial Virginia with hemp. What's another good one? Hemp prohibition didn't get off to a very good start. After 1937, when hemp was banned, immediately noticed the drug war shipping jobs offshore. The Navy needs 40 tons of rigging for each hemp vessel, each Navy vessel. So they're getting it from the Philippines, but in 1942, the Japanese captured the Philippines. So the USDA has to reverse course immediately, 5 years into prohibition, and make this propaganda film that sounds like your roommate with the lava lamp. It praises hemp so fiercely, begging farmers to grow it for the war effort. You can still see it on YouTube and whatnot, called
Amazing.
Hemp for Victory.
Amazing. And with hemp, I mean, do people ingest it and, you know, do they eat it as a food?
I do every day. This hemp seed oil is really a total superfood. It has qualities that you get in fish oil and flax oil. So for people who are vegetarians or vegans, it has those qualities that a fish oil would have. And it's difficult for vegetarians to get high magnesium, high protein. It's just a very, very healthy food, and it makes also a great animal feed as well.
If it's supposed to be illegal, how did that guy get it for his hemp mobile, for example? How do you get it to eat?
That's what is so incredible and absurd about hemp prohibition, and thank God it's coming to an end. We're allowed to import hemp products from other countries. We're allowed to do everything that you can do with hemp. But we are not allowed to cultivate it in the U.S., and that's what the American Revolution was fought about, was other countries having this economic benefit that our producers weren't allowed to benefit from. Now, as bad as that is, I do think there is an upside to prohibition, and I found this out when I researched the worldwide hemp industry. There's almost no overlap in different parts of the world from hemp cultivators. The Canadians are doing only that seed oil, the nutritive seed oil we were talking about. The Chinese are doing only textiles, and by the way, I wear a lot of hemp clothing today, and it's Chinese-grown because they're the only ones doing it. And the Europeans are doing what you might call 21st-century stuff. They're growing hemp fibers we already talked about car parts, but things like 3D printing, body armor, and construction materials. So in the U.S., we can take advantage of what different places in different parts of the world are doing and do it all here now that this nightmare of prohibition is ending.
What does hemp clothes look like?
Very, very soft. It's interesting. In the fashion industry, in the textile industry, the softness of any fiber is called hand. And you're looking for a very soft hand. So if you go to, let's say, a mall and you buy a cotton T-shirt that's super, super soft, that is a very good hand. Hemp, the Chinese are showing, can be as soft as silk if it's produced in the right way. So there will come a time when we're going to see hemp as the go-to material for almost all of our fabrics. And the reason for this is, cotton uses 30% of the world's pesticides. It's so pesticide-heavy that it's poisoning soil the world over. Now, that's not good for the earth, but it's also reducing productivity, and cotton is not producing the way that it once was. Whereas hemp, if you go to the Canadian government website for hemp, under pesticides and herbicides, it says none needed. It grows like a weed.
Is it legal in Canada?
It is. Their industry is going to pass $1 billion this year. They really are growing 24% per year. They can't keep up. I interviewed one of their hemp oil processors up there, and he was undergoing his fourth expansion in 10 years, saying, when the heck are you guys going to legalize it for cultivation? We need you. We can't keep up with it up here.
Well, when we take phone calls next hour, Doug, let's challenge some of our Canadian neighbors to call us and let us know how things are going. How long has it been legal there?
15 years. This is their 16th season. They started in 1998 and did it very much the way that we're doing it now. They started with a few years of research into finding out what cultivars grow best in their soil, and then they haven't looked back. Like I say, growing 24% per year. It's because people all over the world are discovering how healthy the seed oil is. That's primarily what they grow for in Canada.
Okay, it doesn't have the THC like pot. Do people smoke it?
No. You can use it for certain medicinal benefits other than just the nutritive benefits. It has some of the other cannabinoids or components of cannabis that people are finding to be medicinal, but it doesn't have any psychoactivity at all. You could smoke it day and night forever, and it wouldn't have any psychoactive effect.
I would bet, Doug, if we polled people, this is what's so amazing. If we polled people and talked to them about hemp and pot, most of them would probably say it's one and the same. Don't you think?
I think you're probably right, George, but the sea change in public opinion that I'm finding, especially in rural America, is happening very, very fast, and that's because farmers are smart. They're businessmen and they're businesswomen, and they read the journals, and they know very well that just a few inches north of the border, talk to a North Dakotan, they might be the most conservative anti-drug person in the world. They know it's time to grow hemp because the Canadians are making so much money from it.
Let's talk a little bit about the seeds, if we can, Doug, because I guess that's pretty important, isn't it?
It's a fascinating part of it to me, because you can spin the globe, and as long as your finger doesn't stop on Antarctica, there's a cultivar or variety of hemp that's cultivated just about every place in the world. So American farmers, let's say you're in Missouri, and you want to start cultivating hemp. You have to look at things like what's your elevation, rainfall, soil quality, and most of all, phytoperiod. How much daylight do you have at each time of year? And you can find someplace, it might be Uzbekistan, it might be China, and it might be Cameroon, where there's a cultivar that will work in your soil. And another interesting thing about hemp cultivation is that it's a bridge crop. In other words, it grows very, very quickly, as quickly as a 70-day growth cycle. So farmers can use it for this very profitable seed oil harvest. It also is phytoremediating. It helps heal damaged soil. And then you can also grow other crops for the rest of the year. So it's very, very much a win-win for farmers.
Now tell me again about this tainting of the Kentucky seed.
It died out, unfortunately. Well, so hemp prohibition sort of crept up on people. They weren't used to it. Prior to the 1937 banning of hemp on the federal level, the USDA used to do research for farmers to develop the best cultivars, and including, by the way, on land that's today the Pentagon. And so farmers in the U.S. developed what everyone in the whole world wanted, was the best seed stock. But when it was banned, they just kept a couple of bags of it at the National Seed Repository. And a few years ago, a researcher went, and it was kind of this Indiana Jones kind of thing where they had to dust off the old, you know, filing, pre-computerized filing cabinets to find out where the seed even was, go into some back warehouse, pry open a crate with a crowbar, and unfortunately the seed was rotted. So we're starting from scratch now. There is what they call ditchweed that survived despite eradication efforts in places like Nebraska that may provide the basis for rebuilding our seed stock.
What's going on with hemp in other countries, Doug?
It's a hugely growing industry. One application that I find really interesting is primarily being done in Europe, and it's in construction. There's a material called hempcrete, and it's just simply chopped up hemp fiber mixed with lime. And believe it or not, I went to a university research study at the University of Manitoba. Hempcrete, which is light and airy, it doesn't require high heat, and it's not difficult to work with. It actually has a higher R value or insulating value than pink fiberglass insulation. So once we're cultivating this thing domestically, we can be building homes more inexpensively and more efficiently at the same time. And again, this is not some kind of woo-woo, wearing a tie-dye kind of thing. It's Marks & Spencer department store in Britain just built a huge flagship store in a suburb of London out of hempcrete. It really works.
That's amazing. Is there a downside to hemp?
I wouldn't call it a downside, but there are a few caveats. The first one is, if you cultivate for fiber, when you harvest, there's a process that has to happen, a two-week process called redding, and it's medieval. If you look at sketches from 13th century France or Romania, it still looks like the hemp harvest today. You have to bundle up the hemp fiber and let this fungus attack it. Not too much moisture, not too little moisture, rotating it every day for several weeks. And that softens the hard bark on the outside of the hemp plant and allows you access to this incredible, long, strong, bast fiber within that, as I mentioned today, is in BMW and Mercedes door panels. So redding is very risky. If there's too much rain after harvest, it can ruin the whole crop. There's an alternative called decortication, and it's just stripping the bark off right on the day of harvest, but the decorticating machines are very, very expensive. So we have a little bit of work to do before we can get the fiber really back up to speed in the U.S.
Sounds like a fussy plant, is it?
It's not hard. It's not fussy when you're growing it, and it's not fussy to harvest for the seed oil, which is where all the money is today. But when you're talking about those high-end fiber applications, yeah, maybe fussy's a good word. But, you know, I have faith in American farmers. I have faith in American ingenuity. We'll figure it out.
And it's true. You raise goats in New Mexico, right?
That is true, yes. I milk goats twice a day.
How long have you been doing that?
Oh, 7 or 8 years now. And I should say that one of the things that hemp is valuable for is mitigating climate change, because it's going to provide an energy source for us that's nicer to the earth than coal and petroleum. And this matters to me because I was milking my goats last year, and all of a sudden a black bear comes rushing down from a fire that was set in the hills because it's bone dry in the mountains around my New Mexico home, and leaps the fence and kills most of my goat herd. It was very sad, and it was a traumatic experience. And it's all connected. If we can get this hemp plant back in the ground and start using it for biomass energy, I think we can. It's like a ninth inning opportunity here to mitigate climate change, so we're not dealing with these kind of things that affect my life in a very real way.
How many goats did you lose in that episode?
Six.
Jeez.
Yep, two of them survived, thank God. So we're able to keep the milk and yogurt going on the road. We got kind of a modern little house on the prairie thing going. And my girlfriend, as I may have mentioned, she makes a lot of our clothes, including out of hemp. So we're really putting this plant to use. We diapered our kids in it and used the hemp oil as a part of our morning shake. And there's a soap out there called Dr. Bronner's Soap that's made with hemp oil that's safe to use on kids that we bathe our infants in. So we really use this stuff.
I wonder if you can use it as a suntanning lotion.
I've heard that in shampoos. Today there's a hemp seed cereal that's at the International Space Station. It's called, I hope I can say this, it's called Holy Crap.
I guess you can get away with that part. Well, you know, so what's going on legally now to try to get all this legalized? I mean, does it really have a shot?
It not only has a shot, I'm convinced it absolutely is going to happen, and possibly this year. You know what the real proof for me is that it's bipartisan. We have so much division in this nation now, to the point where politicians, as a strategy, will not speak to politicians of an opposing party or of a different viewpoint, because they're so afraid that when it comes time for election, someone that is more radical in their party is going to come and have a campaign commercial that says, Joe, you know, talk, you know, is soft on this, or talk to the other guys about that. Hemp is completely bipartisan, and if you really want proof, you can look at just a week ago in Kentucky, Republican legislators backed by conservative U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell sued the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, which had seized seed that Kentucky farmers wanted to put in the ground. By the way, I should say completely legally. This farm bill last year legalized it, but the DEA sort of was testing the law and seized the seeds. Kentucky sued, and hey, guess what? A federal judge said, hey, you better give them the seed. The law has changed. Now, I want to say I'm a law enforcement supporter, George. I understand that our our peace officers on all levels are here to help us and help our families. I get that. And but we have to understand that this policy has changed on hemp, and that's for the good of the country. Canada has put its former drug squads to work inspecting their own hemp farms to make sure that the hemp itself has low enough THC, but it's almost unnecessary. There has not been a single case of confusion in Canada's 15-year modern hemp industry.
Well, you know, Doug, I wanted to devote a couple hours tonight to talk about hemp, just to educate people so they would really understand what it is, the fact that, it is not pot. We're supporters, by the way, this program of legalizing marijuana for several reasons. One, I, many years ago, did a story with some people who could not take pharmaceutical-grade prescription pain-pilling drugs. It made them sick. They used marijuana for medicinal purposes for pain, and it did wonders with them. I saw the metamorphosis, the change in these people. And after that, I said, you know what? There's some properties in pot here that are well worth using. Let's do that. And the other thing is I think our jails are just overcrowded with petty drug offenders, and we got to fix that. Well, it's good to know that it looks like society is beginning to agree with the things I've said for the last 15, 20 years.
And thank you for saying them, because it's really brave and important to make this case when you're putting yourself at risk of being painted as some sort of, anti-establishment person, when really you're talking about a stronger America. I did write a previous book to Hempbound called Too High to Fail about that, about ending the war on cannabis for the good of the country. And you mentioned two of the three main reasons. One is, I see it especially in veterans. Veterans are coming back from serving in danger zones, and they're getting good care, despite recent scandals. They're getting good care at the VA, but what happens is after they're getting themselves pieced back together from an IED or whatever harms that they've come into serving the nation, they're being put on these pain pills that are basically opiate. They're basically becoming heroin addicts from pills. And cannabis is helping get veterans' lives back. So you really hit on that, the prison thing, and then there's a third thing that I see from my ranch in southern New Mexico, which is the cannabis being illegal has enriched criminal cartels south of the border, and that puts my family at risk. We see it all the time. There's 80,000 Mexicans have been killed over the last 5 years just south of where I live, and it's the violence spills over the border and puts my family at risk. And the only way, as we learned in alcohol prohibition, to hurt organized crime, organized drug criminals, is to tax and regulate it, and that's going to be good for the tax base. And it also actually, believe it or not, lowers youth use rates when we legalize cannabis. We've discovered in places that have legalized it already and in places that did it a while ago, like Portugal. Less kids have access, believe it or not.
Well, you know, the excitement for the kid is gone. When things like this become legal, they are rebels, and, the excitement is gone.
I think that's absolutely true, the forbidden fruit element. On the hemp side, too, you asked, is it really going to happen? I think it could happen this year if the Senate passes S-359. That will remove hemp entirely from the Controlled Substances Act and allow farmers to grow it at like any other agricultural product. I'd personally like to see that with all versions of cannabis, but it's fine with me if we start with hemp. We have today amber waves of mostly genetically modified grain, and without getting into that sort of controversial issue of are GMOs dangerous, there's a lot of viewpoints on that. But what we do know is that monoculture is not good for the soil. And we also know hemp is so good for restoring soil that it was used around Chernobyl to leach radioactivity from the soil after the disaster there in the Ukraine. So it's something that can really help our soils, which are struggling from drought and monoculture.
Okay, we're going to take phone calls next hour with Doug Fine as we talk about his work, Hempbound. And if you are in Canada and you have some experience or exposure to hemp, definitely call in too. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.